I feel very honored to have him here today. Thinking and writing out on these topics is very essential. I give you Richard Heinberg.
Oh, what a great day. Wonderful. Well, what I would like to do over the course of the next 45 minutes, sorry the light is coming in the way it is, what I'd like to do is talk about what we're transitioning away from and what we're transitioning toward and why it's so important. In doing this, I'm going to start, as I always do in each and every one of my talks, with a little discussion of the context of how we've come to be where we are. And that context mostly has to do with energy. Energy is everything. Without energy, nothing happens. And it's as a result of our human ability to capture energy from our environment in special ways that we are able to do what we do as human beings. Now, during 99% of our history and more, we were using energy primarily from the sun. We gained access to energy that was far more concentrated than anything we had had before. And at that moment in human history, virtually all hell broke loose. Back one, two, three, there we go. One way to think about this is the horsepower in the U.S. economy. Now, go back to about 1850, and about 65% of the horsepower in the U.S. economy was coming from the muscles of domesticated animals. Another 18% from the muscles of people who were laboring. Many of those in 1850, of course, were kidnapped Africans. Only about 16 or 18% of the horsepower in the U.S. economy was coming from fuel-fed machines. Fast forward to 1970, virtually all of the work is being done by machines. This is where we were, you know, in 1850, and this is where we are today. Maybe you've had this experience yourself of running out of gas in your car and having to push it for just a few feet. You know, that's hard work. A car is a heavy thing. Imagine pushing your car for, let's say, 20 or 30 miles. That's the energy equivalent of 6 to 8 weeks of hard human labor. But we get that done for us by 1 gallon of gasoline for which we're paying $4 and complaining. Right? So that's 6 to 8 weeks of hard human labor, energy equivalent, for $4. You can't get labor that cheap anywhere, not in China, not Vietnam, nowhere. And so that's why we have mechanized every process of production and transport that we possibly could over the last 150 years or so. And doing so has yielded enormous economic benefits. Civilizations have come and gone. The tide of the human economies have... Tides of the human economies have ebbed and waned, but just in the last century, we have seen GDP per capita take off as never before in all of human history. There is nothing like it to compare. And whether you consider that in terms of urbanization or the number of motor vehicles or the number of telephones or the number of McDonald's restaurants, it looks like a J curve, you know, starting at virtually zero and then shooting up on the right-hand side of the graph. And we could draw, you know, hundreds of these kinds of graphs, all indicating the kind of, you know, overwhelming rapid advancement and change and growth that's occurred just in the last 100 years. Of course, the most consequential graph of that sort is this one here, world population. We started with fewer than 1 billion of us at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution just 200 years ago. year 1800, fewer than a billion human beings, 7 billion of us today, we have never seen population growth that rapid in our history. If we could have supported 7 billion people 5,000 years ago, we would have had that many, but we couldn't. Today we can. All of this power available to us so quickly, so suddenly, infected our imaginations. Over the course of the last century, we've gained the idea that, you know, we modern industrial human beings can do anything. I love this this illustration from the cover of Modern Mechanics in May 1936. It shows a guy on a 300-mile-per-hour motorcycle, you know, real teenage fantasy. And the articles in the magazine, one of them, "Can science make us live forever?" And another one, "Television, our next industrial boom?" Great. Well, the United States was the epicenter for all of this because this is where the oil age began. The first commercial oil wells were drilled here in our country, and fortunes were made. The first great multinational corporation, Standard Oil, grew up here in the United States. And in the early part of the 20th century, we were the world's foremost oil-producing nation and the world's foremost oil-exporting nation. It's hard sometimes to wrap our minds around that today because we're so used to being a major importer of oil. But in the early part of the 20th century, more than half of all the oil produced in the entire world was coming from oil fields in Southern California and Texas and Pennsylvania, Ohio, and so on. It would be inaccurate to say that we were the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century because Saudi Arabia only produces, what, 15-17% of the world's oil right now. We were producing the bulk of it. And that's why probably this is the country where the automobile industry really took off. The big three automakers became the world's big three corporations. The aircraft industry, all sorts of plastics, chemicals, on and on. All of these industries flourished here in the U.S. because we had the cheap fuel and enormous amounts produced right here domestically. Now, the automobile brought with it a lot. You know, we changed how we designed our cities to accommodate the automobile. We even changed how we design our homes. You know, a typical home devotes 25 to 30% of its floor space to housing cars. You know, who would think of building a new home without a two-car garage or maybe a three- or four-car garage, right? But the automobile changed even our financial system. Prior to the 1920s, people pretty much paid cash for everything they bought. But everybody wanted a car, and a car was a big-ticket item. Not many people could afford to pay cash for a car. So we created a whole credit industry to accompany the spread of the automobile. And we're also during this period of the early 20th century, as you know, fossil fuels were taking over, as the automobile was taking over, we were also changing our monetary system. And this is not unrelated. You know, with all of this rapid growth in economic activity, fossil-fueled economic activity, production and consumption and transportation, we needed more money in order to accomplish all of these new transactions. Right? At that time, the early 20th century, money was still mostly gold and silver. Now, we had had some innovations in banking in the previous two, three, four centuries that resulted in what's called fractional reserve banking. In other words, there was more paper money in circulation than there was gold or silver in the vaults. But nevertheless, the amount of gold and silver that existed was somewhat of a break on the total amount of money that could be created, and it was therefore a kind of damper on economic growth. So over the course of the 20th century, we severed the tie between money and precious metals. This enabled vastly more GDP growth, which is what we saw earlier. More money could be created, more money could change hands. We created a monetary system based on debt. All money is loaned into existence. And the banks are the source for most of the money that exists. When you go to a bank and take out a loan, the bank effectively creates that money right there on the spot. They're not taking a pile of cash from somebody's account and putting it into your account. It's just all done with computer keystrokes. So that debt also comes with the requirement of payment of interest. That's all debt does. You know, if you're taking out a loan from the bank, the expectation is that you're going to pay back that money plus 7% interest or whatever it is. So if all of our money is debt, then where is that interest, where is the interest payment going to come from? Well, it's going to have to come from you doing business with somehow somebody else in the economy who's also taking out a loan. And as long as the total amount that's being loaned into existence is always increasing, then there will always be some way to, you know, get a job or make an investment and returns on your investment and make enough so that you'll be able to pay back your debts plus the interest due on the debts. If the economy as a whole were to stop growing at any given moment, then, you know, people might be able to still make their loan payments, but where would the interest come from? So in a sense, we could say tomorrow's growth is collateral for today's debt. If we didn't all believe that the economy was going to continue growing and growing and growing, then it just wouldn't make sense to make loans today because we wouldn't know where that interest was going to come from. Well, the idea, of course, that the economy is going to grow and grow and grow forever and ever is actually a pretty recent idea. It's grown up, it's appeared, just within this last century or so of cheap fossil fuels that have enabled this rapid pace of industrial growth. But the idea that growth can go on forever on a finite planet, we can always consume more and sell more and buy more and turn more stuff into waste, that idea is inherently kind of questionable. And in fact, there were some folks back in the early 1970s who questioned it rather rigorously. They did a study which was published as a book called Limits to Growth. This was actually the best-selling environmental book ever published, 1972. What they did was to take a computer and feed in data about human population, consumption rates, and rates of depletion of resources to see what would happen. And the result was a series of scenarios. And in most of the scenario runs, they saw a peak and decline in world industrial output in the early 21st century. Now, of course, in the early 1970s, we're talking about very primitive computer, very primitive software, and fairly preliminary data. So, of course, the people who did this Limits to Growth study have redone it many times since then using better computers, better software, better data, and so on. And the result keeps coming out pretty much the same. Peak and decline in industrial output, human population, food production, and all the rest in the early 21st century. Now, it's kind of intuitively obvious that something like that is going to happen because, after all, if so much of what we enjoy today is based on the abundant, cheap, concentrated energy of fossil fuels, well, we know that's not going to last forever because fossil fuels are themselves, you know, depleting non-renewable resources. We only started out with so much. These fuels were made over the course of tens of millions of years by natural processes, nature, you know, slowly cooking mostly, well, I won't go into the details of that, but mostly plant material under very high pressure, very high temperatures. And so these are really special materials, fossil fuels. And we're burning through them at extraordinary rates, you know, 6 billion tons of coal per year, 30 billion barrels of oil per year. So, you know, we don't know exactly when we will run out. That's kind of a theoretical question. But we do know that, you know, at some point we're not going to have any considerable amounts left. Now, whether we're exactly at the pinnacle there of that curve or close to it, it's hard to say, but chances are we're more or less right around that spot. Now, meanwhile, you know, if all money is loaned into existence, so if all money is debt, and the economy has been growing and growing and growing, then you would expect to see a graph like this, right? Total U.S. debt has been growing. That's what enables the monetary supply, the money supply to grow. Now, of course, you note in 2008 that growth stopped. What happened in 2008? Well, we had a little hiccup in our economy that we're still sort of trying to recover from. This is household debt, corporate debt, financial institutional debt, and government debt. All of those categories have declined since 2008, except for government debt, which has grown. Now, the notion that debt is, you know, unsustainable is something that we're starting to become more familiar with, and we're starting to talk about it more as a nation, because we see that there are some inherent limits to debt that maybe we hadn't really talked about or thought about much before. This is the situation with household debt. Now, average wages, hourly wages for American workers peaked in 1973. So we haven't, in inflation-adjusted terms, we're not really making any more money than we were 30 years ago. But Americans have been spending more, you know, in order to help make the economy grow. We've been buying more stuff, you know, and we've had more stuff to buy. Cell phones, smartphones, plasma TVs, hybrid cars, you know, we always have new stuff coming on the market, and you know, if you want to be a good American consumer, you've got to partake in some of that. So how have we done that? By increasing our debt. And the financial community has been happy to help us find ways to do that with, you know, credit cards and debit cards and credit card offers coming through the mail and no-doc loans, on and on and on. So U.S. household debt has increased pretty dramatically over the last 30 years. No surprise there. But debt payments as a percentage of income, that's the right-hand end of the scale, that has increased as well. See, this is the tricky thing. As debt increases, the requirement for interest payment also increases. And that poses kind of a limit. This is the discussion we're having right now about the U.S. Budget deficit and the federal debt. You know, theoretically, if we were to continue with the size of deficits we have currently and taking on more and more debt, we would eventually get to a situation where virtually all federal government outlays would have to go toward paying interest on the debt. And we couldn't afford to do all the other things that the federal government wants to do. Well, obviously, we would run into problems long before we got to that, you know, final impasse. But the same principle holds with household debt, with corporate debt, and so on. So there are inherent limits to debt, just as there are limits to natural resources. What happened in 2008 was we had built a blown up a kind of financial bubble in this country based largely on house prices. And here in California, we were kind of at the epicenter of it, weren't we? You know, as house prices increased, it was so easy to take out loans against the increased value of our homes, right? So people were going into more debt and buying houses at inflated prices, and the financial industry had created all of these, you know, subprime mortgage options and so on. So as property values increased, there was a kind of bubble there, and then the financial community was taking those mortgages and slicing them and dicing them into mortgage-backed securities, which were being sold to pension funds and hedge funds all over the world. And then derivative contracts were being written on those securities. So we had a kind of inverted pyramid of debt with house prices kind of at the bottom there, and at the top were literally hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of what were effectively bets. Bets that this pyramid would continue to grow, right? That the house prices would continue to increase and all the rest. Well, that didn't happen. What did happen was in the middle of 2008, July 2008, oil prices spiked up to $150 a barrel. And in places where people lived far away from their work, where they had long commutes, and these were typically suburban communities, house prices began to fall. And this created a contagion that spread throughout the housing market, and it spread from the bottom of the pyramid to the top, so that by the end of 2008, something like $50 trillion in value in assets worldwide had disappeared. $50 trillion. Now, how much is that? Well, we all know what $100 looks like. $10,000 is just a little packet of those things. I mean, it's handy to have one of those in your back pocket if you're going to Las Vegas for the weekend, right? And even $1 million is just a little pile of cash you can easily stash in a backpack or a briefcase. You know, when I'm going to be walking around town for more than 2 or 3 hours, I like to have one of those with me. $100 million actually requires maybe a, you know, a SUV or a pickup truck. You have to put it on a pallet. $1 billion, now we're talking maybe an 18-wheeler. Not a fully loaded 18-wheeler, but, you know, it requires a bit bigger vehicle. Now, $1 trillion, we're actually talking about real money here. But this is the scale that we've achieved in our economic growth. Now, of course, since 2008, we're told that the economy is recovering. And this is U.S. GDP growth rate. You can see before 2009, you know, wobbling a little bit, then this huge dip that bottoms out around the beginning of first few months of 2009. And then starting at the last quarter of 2009 and on, we see some modest growth in GDP. So what's going on there? Well, most of that is based upon government spending, either the Treasury or the Federal Reserve. We've seen huge stimulus packages, bailouts, loan guarantees, quantitative easing, you know, the Federal Reserve buying government debt. So as we saw earlier, government debt has increased as all of the other categories of debt have been shrinking. You know, if we want to have GDP growth, we have to have growth in debt. And if that growth in debt isn't happening in the private sector, then somebody's got to step in and pick up the slack, and that's what the government's been doing. Now, you can say, well, that's a good thing or that's a bad thing, and people on different sides of the political spectrum are arguing that right now. But I would argue, if you take that away, we haven't really seen any economic growth since 2008. And here's a little evidence to that effect. This was a headline just a few weeks ago. U.S. economy's growth cools in first quarter to 1.8% annual rate. Let me read you the first sentence of this article from Bloomberg. The U.S. economy slowed more than forecast in the first quarter as government spending declined by the most since 1983. So take away government debt, government spending, and we're not really seeing any growth. So all of this is to say that world economic growth seems to have hit a speed bump. We are encountering the limits to debt. Now, theoretically, that's something we could figure out and solve. We'd probably have to redesign our financial system. We'd probably have to redesign money itself and find ways of creating currency that don't involve debt and interest. Nevertheless, it could be done. And presumably then, we'd still go on our merry way with more economic growth. However, we have some problems that are external to the monetary and financial system that are also choking off growth. Primarily, the situation with world oil supplies. Now, as we saw earlier, U.S. used to be major world producer and exporter of oil. But discoveries of oil in the U.S. peaked out in 1930. You know, we still find oil in the U.S. in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico and maybe a little bit in other places, but relative dribs and drabs compared to what we were finding in the 1930s. U.S. oil production peaked in 1970. And even if we bring online, you know, all of the places that are currently off limits, it's not going to make much difference. You know, the U.S. is the most explored region of the world. There have been more oil wells drilled in the U.S. than in the rest of the world put together. So this is what we have here is a fully mature oil-producing province. And get used to it. But the same thing is happening elsewhere. World oil discoveries have been declining since 1964. So again, we are finding oil in offshore Brazil, the Gulf of Guinea, off West Africa, Angola, Algeria. You know, there's a list of countries that are seeing increasing production. But there's just as big a list of countries that are past peak, like the U.S., that are seeing declining discoveries and production. And as a result, this is what actual world crude oil production has looked like over the last few years. It's been basically flat since 2005. And this in the context of very high prices. Go back to the year 2000 and read the forecasts from the International Energy Agency or the U.S. Department of Energy. Forecasts for what oil would cost in the year 2010, 2011. All of those forecasts say we should be paying $20 a barrel right now. Okay, adjust that for inflation, $30 a barrel, maybe $35. Worst case scenario, $40 a barrel. It's actually $100 a barrel in New York and $115 elsewhere. And we have seen fluctuating prices since 2005, but nevertheless, historically, very, very high prices. So that would be an incentive for producers who are able to bring as much oil to market as they possibly can. And indeed, there is very good evidence that all world producers are producing flat out, with the possible exception of Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis, we really don't know about. The general belief is that they have 3 or 4 million barrels a day of spare oil production capacity, but when called upon to produce it, they don't. Their situation is entirely opaque. Their oil reserves, their oil production, everything about their operations is just a matter of self-reporting. The International Energy Agency doesn't send a team over to Saudi Arabia to monitor their oil wells and their oil fields. No, we just have to take their word for it. So as far as we can tell, for all practical purposes, the world is producing as much oil right now just about as it can. And it's different oil than it was a few years ago. You know, this is what the oil industry looked like a few decades ago. This is what it looks like today. You know, a single exploratory oil well can cost $500 million to drill, and it may still come up dry. This is a very risky industry, increasingly so, because we have exhausted the low-hanging fruit. And really, that's a perfect metaphor to use when discussing non-renewable resources like oil, coal, and natural gas. We're not about to run out of any of these resources. There's still lots of hydrocarbon molecules in the Earth's crust, but we preferentially went after the cheap, easy stuff first, the highest quality, the easiest to access. And so what's left is increasingly costing more to produce, and also is producing worse and worse environmental impacts as we extract it. As we saw in the Gulf of Mexico last year with the Deepwater Horizon blowout, I think that kind of opened a lot of Americans' eyes to what's really going on. These are the lengths to which we have to go these days to produce new oil in this country. So this creates an economic problem for us. We need, the oil industry needs oil prices of about $80 a barrel now to justify new exploration and production. Now, I give talks on this general subject all the time, and 18 months ago when I gave this talk, that number was $60. Right? So the number is increasing pretty rapidly these days. Now, this is not to say that every barrel of oil costs $80 to produce. There are still oil fields in the world that can produce oil profitably with a price of $20, but that's not what sets the world oil price. If world oil demand were small enough that all of it could be supplied by that $20 a barrel oil, then that's all that oil would cost. But we want more than that. And so the marginal barrel that has to be produced from these exotic sources to satisfy that marginal barrel of demand, that's what sets the total oil price across the board throughout the world. So we need that price to be at least $80 a barrel. Meanwhile, we know from recent economic history that when the oil price gets to $100 a barrel, approximately, economic mayhem ensues. Look at this. These gray vertical bars are recessions since 1970, and the jagged red line is inflation-adjusted oil prices. Every time we've had a price spike in oil, we've had a recession immediately following. And of course, in 2008, we had the mother of all oil price spikes, and we had the worst recession since the Great Depression immediately following. So where are we now? With oil at $100 a barrel right now, if the oil price stays there for another couple of months, it's almost guaranteed that the U.S. economy is going to tip back over into recession, even if we can still manage to keep pumping the same amount of money, government money, into the economy. We're in a very precarious situation here. And over the short term, we're talking about this summer. Now, of course, the problem of peak oil is not just a matter of the world financial system. We're looking at fundamental challenges to the world's transport system. The fact that, you know, we still have 200 million gas-guzzling cars, trucks, and SUVs in this country, even though every president in the last 40 years, every president of either party has said, we've got to reduce our dependence on oil. We're addicted to oil, said one president recently. Okay, but what have we done about it? Virtually nothing. So here we are, still relying on a transport system that's over 95% oil dependent and with no real plan B. And meanwhile, our food system is also overwhelmingly reliant on cheap oil. In the last few years, food prices and oil prices have begun to move virtually in lockstep. You know, we had this big oil price spike in 2008, and that year also food prices shot up, and we had food riots in over 100 countries around the world. This year, oil prices again have shot up, and we actually have record food prices this year, which have fed into the uprisings that we've seen in North Africa and the Middle East. I mean, these are countries that import a very large percentage of their food. These countries also have very high population growth rates, very high levels of unemployment for young people. So when fuel prices and food prices go up in these countries, young people especially are put into a situation where they basically have nothing to lose. So if for the past two or three decades, the people of these countries have been willing to put up with dictators and monarchs and so on, well, at this point, again, with nothing to lose, why not go out into the streets and rebel? People are hungry. Well, clearly then, you know, if higher prices for oil threaten the economy, and if shortages of oil threaten our food system, our transport system, and so on, we need some other sources of energy, and we need them fast. So what are they going to be? It's not an easy question to answer. There really are no silver bullets out there. At Post Carbon Institute, we did a study a couple of years ago, which you can find as a free PDF download on our website. It's called Searching for a Miracle. We looked at 18 different energy sources and analyzed them according to 10 criteria. Among those criteria, energy return on investment. You know, it takes energy to get energy. You have to invest energy in drilling an oil well or building a solar panel. So how much energy do you get back? Is it more than you invested? Well, hopefully. Otherwise, it's not worth it. Well, for oil, in the early days, the energy return was on the order of 100 to 1 or more. And that's what enabled us to create an urban society, an urban industrial society. Prior to then, most people had to work at farming, and farming is basically energy production. If you think about it, you know, food is our most basic form of energy. So far, if you have a society of farmers, you have a society of energy producers. But we replaced the vast majority of our farmers with tractors and other farm machinery running on oil. So now we only have, you know, 2% of our population working at food production, maybe another percent or two working in the oil and gas and coal industries, and everybody else gets to screen baggage for TSA or, you know, work at the checkout counter in Walmart or whatever. I mean, we have 10 architects, doctors, musicians. We have thousands and thousands of occupations for middle-class people today that didn't even exist before because, you know, previously everybody had to work at more basic levels of production. So as we move down the energy return on energy invested ratio to fuels like solar photovoltaics and even tar sands and biodiesel, we're talking about a different kind of society. If those become our primary energy sources, we're going to have to invest much more in terms of labor, capital, and total societal effort into energy production, and we'll have a lot less left over to do all the other sorts of things we want to do. So that's a constraint, but there are lots of others. I'm not going to talk at great length about these, but the size of the resource, the infrastructure requirement, the convenience of use, the environmental impact. This is Fukushima Reactor 3. Nuclear power, too big an environmental impact, too big a risk. We've just taken that one off the list. Thank you very much. Renewability, scalability, location of the resource. At the end of the day, we came to the conclusion in our study that there is no credible scenario in which alternative energy sources can fully make up for fossil fuels as fossil fuels deplete. Now, we realize that there are some other studies that have reached different conclusions, and the reason is they failed to take into account some of these criteria, such as energy return on energy invested. Now, of course, there are, in addition to the depletion of fossil fuels, there are other constraints on economic growth that are appearing very rapidly also, like the cost of extreme weather events and the cost of environmental disasters. As this of course, is Japan after the earthquake and tsunami. Will Japan recover? You know, with relatively small natural disasters, they actually help the GDP because we spend money on recovery from the disaster that we wouldn't otherwise spend. So let's bring on some more natural disasters and we'll have more GDP. Well, it's kind of a perverse logic, but that's been the state of affairs. But the problem is, once the disaster becomes of a certain size, it no longer is possible for an economy to fully recover from it. And I think that's the situation that Japan faces. Japan will probably never recover from the catastrophe it's just experienced in the classical sense. It will adjust in some way or another, but it won't really recover. And I think that's going to be true of the world as a whole, as we see more and more impacts from climate change and from other some of the other environmental costs from what we're doing with fossil fuels. Well, okay, I have been arguing a proposition with you. The proposition is that world economic growth is over. And that's going to be a very controversial thesis. It's the thesis of my new book, which is coming out this summer. And I fully expect, if I ever get on some TV show or NPR or whatever, I fully expect, you know, whoever is interviewing me or debating me is going to say, well, what about China? You know, China's economy is still growing at 10% per year. What, are you stupid or something? Well, yeah, let's look at China's economy. Actually, I have a fairly long analysis of what's going on in China that's on our website right now. If you go to postcarbon.org, I can't run you through the whole set of evidence and argument right now, but I just say, you know, China is a bubble. Anything that's growing at 10% per year is doubling in size every 7 years. Think about that. China's economy is doubling in size every 7 years. How long can it keep doing that? Well, I would suggest on the basis of limits to China's coal supply, and China has an almost overwhelmingly coal-dependent economy, just on the basis of limits to China's coal supply, that we will see a reversal of China's growth trajectory this decade. Well, what about efficiency? Can't we just increase energy efficiency and have more economic growth? Can't we substitute other fuels and materials for stuff that's running out? But innovation is always producing more economic growth. Aren't we going to have more innovation? Aren't we going to have more electronic gizmos and so on? Yes. Well, I would say efficiency, substitution, and innovation are going to be the strategies that we will use to adapt to the end of growth. And if we're smart, we will adapt well using those strategies. But will they by themselves be able to enable us to continue to grow the economy in the face of depleting fossil fuels and increasing expense of extraction of other resources? I don't think so. You know, up until 2000, most of the commodities, raw materials, in the world were becoming cheaper and cheaper every year. This is why economists looked at the limits to growth study and said, oh, that can't be right. You know, it sounds like, you know, we're running out of everything, but how can that be true if copper's getting cheaper, iron ore's getting cheaper, aluminum's getting cheaper? Sounds pretty good, right? Well, what was happening was we were, in fact, having to go to lower and lower grades of ore, whether it was silver or zinc or antimony or rare earths. We were having to go to lower and lower grades of ore, but we had the cheap energy with which to do that. We could refine the stuff more. We could mine all the rare earths in China and ship the material to, you know, California if we wanted to start an electronics factory in California and use the, you know, we had a globalized system of resource production, and that's what was reducing the costs or the prices of these raw materials. But since the year 2000, that trend has reversed. The price of, again, everything from antimony to zinc, including iron ore and copper ore and rare earths, the prices have been going up. We are facing a kind of wall here, a financial and resource and environmental wall. How are we going to get around it? This is what we have to expect: unemployment, homelessness, bank failures, hunger, crime, political instability, and international conflict. Thank you very much. It's been good talking to you. Okay. So if the first thing we have to do is get around the financial part of the wall, because if we don't do that, we're not going to have the wherewithal to do any of the rest of this stuff. We need to change, you know, we need to change our transport system and our food system and our built environment and all this other stuff. But if we don't have a functioning financial system, we can't do anything. Right? If the money goes away, then we can't do. So we need fundamental monetary reform. And this realistically is not likely to happen until we have another financial crisis. But we ought to at least know what to do when that happens. We need a non-debt-based currency that's based on something like direct credit clearing. And that's, it may sound complex, but it's not. I mean, probably everybody knows the airlines' mile systems. You know, you fly and then you accrue so many miles and you can trade those in for a flight. Well, that's like, it's a type of money. It's a currency, but the banks aren't issuing it. There's no interest attached to it. It's just an agreement between the airline companies and their customers. Well, we can do this with regard to just about everything. We can find ways to get around the need for banks and interest just by direct credit clearing systems. And there are over 250 local currencies in operation around the world right now that have no basis in debt and interest. I could talk more about these, but the local currencies are a great thing to have as an insurance policy for when the dominant currency, national currency, goes south. But at a more basic level, beyond money itself, economics as a discipline has to grow up. You know, economics was developed during the last century of this anomalous period of cheap energy and cheap credit. And so economists embedded some fundamental mistakes into their discipline. Of course, one of these was the idea that growth could go on forever in a finite system. Another was that the economy, that the environment is a subset of the economy. Economists actually believe that the environment is just a pile of resources that we use for production, and then at the other end of production is consumption and waste. But, of course, the reality is that the human economy is a subset of the environment, always has been and always will be. So we got to get that straight. We've also got to understand that growth in population and consumption levels is not sustainable, that renewable resources have to be harvested at less than the rate of natural replenishment, and non-renewable resources have to be recycled, and the use of them has to decline. And finally, that waste from industrial processes has to be food, either for other industrial processes or for natural processes. These ideas, these I wouldn't even call them ideas, these axioms are so simple that the average 10-year-old can grasp them easily, but most PhD economists simply can't wrap their heads around them. Somehow that's got to change. Again, our food systems, our transport systems have to be reinvented. But, you know, we've had people working on these things for decades, whether it's bike systems and public transport systems or organic farming, local food systems, and so on. You know, here in this town, there are people working exactly on those issues and have been for a long time. But they've been the minority. They've been outside the mainstream. That's got to change. And it may take a crisis for that to happen. But we have to have these tools lying around for that crisis moment when that's what is going to save us. This is a great quote from Milton Friedman. I don't think he had organic farming in mind, but it certainly applies. You know, even if we do all the right things, even if we build Transition Albany and Transition Berkeley and Transition California and Transition US and Transition Earth, the reality is that we've gone so far out on a limb that it's going to be a difficult process of adaptation and adjustment. We have some hard times ahead of us. Now, that's scary, yes, but we human beings have been through hard times before. It's actually just, you know, we in North America for the past 50 years have lived in an extraordinarily cushy economy. We've forgotten what hard times are all about, so the very thought that we could be facing hard times is like mega scary. We don't even know how to handle it. So it's good sometimes to kind of sit back and put things in perspective. You know, societies have grown and contracted, and most people in the world use a tiny percentage of the amount of stuff and energy that we use, and yet they get by. What we need to do is build a much more resilient kind of society. Resilience, what's that? Well, in many ways, it's the opposite of economic efficiency. Again, I hate to be jumping on economists all the time, but they want us to increase economic efficiency at every opportunity. And efficiency, you know, sounds like a good thing, like energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is a good thing, but economic efficiency means something like if you can grow corn cheaper in Iowa than anywhere else, then we should grow all of our corn in Iowa, and we shouldn't grow anything in Iowa except corn. That creates a very brittle kind of society, because if the crop in Iowa fails for any reason, then nobody anywhere has any corn, right? And that's the kind of economy we're striving to create with economic efficiency. And that's why the disaster in Japan is resulting in slowdowns in factories around the world, because Japan was uniquely producing certain components that are necessary for the production process all over the place. So resilience often means redundancy. It means producing more locally for local consumption. That's very much what transition is all about. Transition is, first of all, starts with the premise that life can be better without fossil fuels. Yeah. We're going to live without them anyway, so let's make the best of it, you know? And life was not so bad before fossil fuels, and it can be okay after fossil fuels. And the fact is, the gift of fossil fuels enabled us to learn a lot of really cool stuff about how the world works and the universe works and how our own human body works. Science has been really good to us in terms of giving us the tools to understand where we are and how to get from here to a sustainable society. In addition to transition, there are lots of other things we could do, or maybe this could be a project of transition. But this is a horn that I'm tooting wherever I go. It seems to me that every town should have a one-stop shop somewhere, hopefully near the middle of town, where everybody can recognize that there's something different happening, right? Every town, pretty much, of any size, has a credit union and a job center and a food co-op or a car share, ride share, bicycle co-op, whatever. But usually these things are scattered all over town and they are fringy alternative. What if we put as many of those things together as we can into one place close to the middle of town, so if somebody is hurting economically and they're going, I got to do something different, I can't afford to fill up my car with gas anymore, what are the alternatives? Well, there is a place right there in the middle of town that has a car share, a ride share, a bicycle co-op, and other. So if you need help, or if you have help to give, if you have skills to teach, there is a place you can go to contribute. There, I know that these are starting to spring up in a few places, and in my book I have a page that with just references of towns that are starting to build these things. So, okay, peak oil, peak debt, peak civilization, who knows? But there are a lot of things that aren't at peak, that in fact we've had to give up in order to have more GDP growth. We've had to give up the sense of community, of satisfaction from honest work well done in many cases, because we've divided the production process into smaller and smaller pieces so that, you know, most of us never get to see a whole creative process. We just have our own little thing that we do. Intergenerational solidarity, you know, parents and their kids and grandparents and grandkids don't even speak the same language anymore. I mean, if you don't have a smartphone at least, you know, where are you? And if you're not listening to Lady Gaga, my God, what kind of troglodyte? as, you know, one of the effects of a contracting economy is that things are going to slow down. And maybe moving a little slower is not such a bad thing. It might give us a little perspective, a little more of a sense of appreciation of one another. More free time, happiness, artistry, the beauty of the built environment. These things we actually had more of in the past. I'm going to close by just suggesting that this transition that we are embarking upon is a very, very big deal. We've had several really big transitions in our history as a species, starting with the harnessing of fire millions of years ago. We don't know exactly when, but good guess would be 3-4 million years ago, which enabled us to cook our food. It changed how we think, our physiology, our DNA, everything else. Language enabled us to coordinate our behavior over space and time. I mean, religion, science, none of this would be possible without language, without the ability to communicate abstract concepts. Language, we don't know exactly when it came about. A good guess would be 50,000 years ago, but that could be way off the mark. But that, agriculture, something like 7,000 to 10,000 years ago, again, gave us enormous power over our environment, enabled us to produce seasonal surpluses that led to the building of cities and empires. Civilization, which is about cities, is a result of agriculture. And then the fossil fuel industrial revolution of the last couple of hundred years, which again resulted in a vast expansion of our power over our environment, human population expanding and all the rest. Well, the sustainability revolution is going to be equal in importance and scale to any of these, but perhaps even more so, because each of these previous transitions involved our increasing our impact upon the world, increasing our power over our environment. The sustainability revolution will be about our recognizing our limits. It's going to be about self-limitation, about the human species saying, enough. Enough is enough. And that's like growing up as a species, right? This is where we actually come into our maturity. So I would say, you know, we're in for a remarkable time, and how great that we can actually talk to each other using language about this and have some understanding of the process that we're going through and make the most of it. You know, the one of the great gifts of being human is the ability to make the most of whatever life sends our way. Well, every crisis is an opportunity. We are facing the greatest opportunity of our lifetime, probably any human lifetime. So let's make the most of it. Thank you very much.